NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
The National Weather Service has posted advisories for several plain states. Roads are treacherous in parts of Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, and South Dakota, where the state National Guard has been called out. The Weather Service says it's possible 4 inches of snow could fall as far north as Wisconsin. In South Dakota, power crews are working to restore electricity to some customers. A 22-year-old man from Denmark has won the World Series of Poker. Peter Eastgate was declared the champion in the competition staged in Las Vegas. The professional poker player takes home more than $9 million and the coveted gold bracelet. He defeated Russian Ivan Demidov, who says he hopes his performance will help the event grow. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to expanding human welfare through economic growth, on the web at kauffman.org.
Programming on WILL-AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to experience the Dresden Staatskapelle on November 15th, as well as the Takacs Quartet, Muzsikás, and Marta Sebastian on November 19th. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Cal Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be looking back to some of the early history of radio, concentrating, roughly speaking, on just the first couple of decades and how quickly it grew and how people realized it had great commercial potential and, of course, how it became a very powerful cultural, political, and economic force. And our guest for the program is Anthony Riddell. He is the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. The book's published by Harcourt, out now in the store, so you'd like to take a look at it. Our guest has spent his professional life in radio, including 10 years on the air. He also had stints as vice president of programming for WQXR New York and also for SW Radio Networks. He's the author of the novel Imagining Don Giovanni, and two works on classical music. He now consults for radio stations across the country, and he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, you might be listening on the internet. You may use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. And at any point here, you have questions, comments for our guests, you can give us a call. Mr. Riddell, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks.
In fact, yourself. I'd probably say hello, everybody. The
well,
proper beginning.
I'm really pleased you could be with us. It's good to talk to another radio guy.
Yeah.
As somebody who continues to believe in the power of radio and its potential, at least we hope that it will continue to have potential. I know I just heard you quickly talking with one of our producers, Harriet, about young people in radio and something that we've all noted, that is, it seems that young people don't listen to the radio, and you sort of wonder, you know, what's going to happen to the audience in the future if we can't manage to persuade people under 20 to get into the habit of listening to the radio.
You know, it's funny. It's kind of like classical music and audiences, and how I've been in that side of the business as well. And QXR is a classical music station. And there's always this ongoing battle: how are we going to attract audiences? And it sounds like, you know, the newest battle in the world: how are we going to bring the people in? I think it was the Chicago Symphony or the New York Philharmonic. Somebody I knew in the marketing department was clearing out an old office, and they found a file from 1930-something, and it was the marketing director in 1930 writing a memo about what are we going to do about the future when there's no young audience. So the part of me thinks it's just everybody comes along, grows up, and they go, oh, look, radio's pretty cool. Let me go to that now. I think part of what will change that, it's a positive because I'm an optimist about radio, is that as we as people mature and as radio becomes more central and local again as opposed to this sort of the commercial radio having this, you know, homogeneity from coast to coast, the local things, things as what you do in your local community, become much more relevant. So I think we're going to sort of move back to that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that, just to talk about how quickly radio spread, and maybe one way to talk about it is this. If you look at this period where that you cover in your book, which is, you know, sort of roughly from the early 20s to, say, 1940, if you look at the point where we start to have stations licensed and where it's possible for people to go out and buy radio so they don't have to build their own, you know, how much, say, in the early 20s, when we started to see stations going on the air and radios commercially available, how many stations were there and how many radios? And then, say, by 1941, how had that grown?
Well, let me give you two bookends that I think are the most relevant ones, and it's a statistic I use in talking about this, and actually why I wrote the book, because nobody had focused on this before. In 1920, November 2nd of 1920, KDKA Pittsburgh decided to do the presidential election returns, the election that put Harding and Coolidge into office over Cox and a man named Franklin Roosevelt, who was running as vice president for the Democrats. November 2nd, 1920, they did the broadcast from the roof of the Westinghouse building in East Pittsburgh, and they estimated that somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people heard that broadcast. 12 years later, when that young man, Franklin Roosevelt, defeated Hoover for the presidency on November 4th, 1932, they estimate that coast-to-coast, somewhere around 60 million people listened. Now, to put that in perspective, there was an article the other day that I read that said that television coverage of last week's election was viewed by 70 million people. So 60 million out of a population of about 110 million listened in 1932, and 70 million out of a population probably double that size now listened in 2008. So the real great growth of radio was 1920 to 1932, when there were probably 800 radio stations on the air.
And you, obviously, we don't want to underestimate the continuing importance of the internet. And when television became widespread, that was certainly very important.
Sure.
If you think about going back to a time when mass communications would have been what kind of national or regional print media existed, and there was telegraph, and there was the post. But to go from that to this point where we could have programming coming out of one location and across the country is in their own homes, so just sitting there in their living rooms or wherever next to the box, you could have 60 million people all at the same time tuned into a particular event.
Yeah.
That's sort of, you know, going from what there was before to that in a relatively short period of time, that's pretty staggering.
Also, you know, the comparison people have made in reading the book, people have said to me, well, you know, television grew very fast and the internet has grown so fast. But my point, and you sort of just touched on it, is that both television and the internet had the groundwork that was laid by radio for mass communication, which radio didn't have the advantage of. There was nothing before radio that was like radio. I always have this image of a farmer somewhere in the middle of the country coming home from the, you know, the county fair or the state fair or something, you know, or the, his annual visit to the big city, and he comes home to his wife and he says, "I bought something," and she said, "What's that?" And he takes out from the back of his, you know, buggy or whatever it was, a box with some wires and tubes and a battery, and he says, "This is a radio." And she says, "What do we do with it?" He says, "Well, at night I put the battery in, we turn it on, and we can listen to music from New York or Chicago or California." And she says, "What do you call it?" He says, "We call it a radio." And she says, "Well, how much did that cost?" And he said, "It's $75. It's really amazing. You turn it on and you just get sound from all over the country." And she looks at me and says, "Well, clearly you've been drinking again," because the concept had to be so foreign to people that you could, as you said, sit in your living room and have this invisible sound come into your home. Pretty incredible.
Yeah, and I suppose, too, that for at that time, I guess for a lot of people, the idea of spending $75 on something, that would have been a lot of money.
That was huge.
That
was a huge amount of money in 1920 or 21.
Yeah.
Just a huge amount of money. So it was the growth of the industry is really amazing. I mean, it's really one of the great chicken and egg concepts ever to come along. Think about this. Why would you make radio programs if no one has a radio? And why would you buy a radio if nobody's doing radio programs? But somehow the companies that were building the radios caught on and said, aha, we need programming, or as we call it today, we need content. And so they started doing, you know, things like the election results, and then they did a boxing match, and then they did a football game, and all of a sudden people said, hey, this is pretty cool. And that's where the growth came.
Well, that's, and I think that's an interesting point, because it seems to me that early on, one of the main reasons that some of the people were producing content, that they were producing programming, was to sell radios, because they knew, obviously, there was nothing to listen to. Nobody was going to buy their radios. When do we come to the idea that the programming and using that as a an avenue for commercial messages starts to be an end in itself, not programming so you can get somebody to buy the radio, but programming so you can get somebody to buy something else?
Well, you really, I see the, if you look at the decade or the 12 years that I write about from 20 to 32, I sort of view 1925 as the turning point. And it was really fascinating to see how it was a hobby. And, yeah, people had tried some commercials and, you know, this and that, a little bit of growth and a lot of experimentation. And frankly, anything went as programming. I mean, I read an article from some paper in California that said that the particular radio station was going to turn itself back on. They were going to turn the transmitter back on. In those days, I mean, 24/7, forget about it. You were lucky if a radio station did an hour a day, 7 days a week. So, you know, they came on and off the air. And they issued a press announcement that said, on Thursday at 3 o'clock, we're going to turn the transmitter back on because a guy is coming into town who's going to come and whistle the first act of Carmen. And you think about it, this was great programming. He could whistle the whole first act, and you could turn your radio on and listen to him. But in 1925, you start seeing some really fascinating things. For one thing, the New York Times, in September of 1925, devotes an entire supplement to the radio, which they'd never done before. That summer was also the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee. And it was a radio station in Chicago, actually, WGN, that ran a phone line from Dayton to Chicago and broadcast the monkey trial. You think about the participants. You had William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. That must have been some pretty good radio. Mm-hmm. So content begins to drive things in the early 20s. Then by 1925, people are seeing a business. The counter to the business, of course, was Herbert Hoover, the Secretary of Commerce, who was a brilliant Secretary of Commerce and really guided the growth of radio and made it happen. But he was dead set against commercial. He thought this was the wrong way to fund this business. And he made a comment somewhere along the line, which he said, can you imagine a presidential speech as the meat in a sandwich between two commercials? And he was offended by this concept. You know, little did he know what was going to happen within the next couple of years in terms of a flood, an absolute flood of commercial content. And then you have the networks, NBC in 26, 27, and CBS in 28, start coming along. And, of course, they're funded completely by advertising and national advertising. So, you know, the content and the advertising all comes together. But really the turning point, I think, of when it became a business was 1925.
Let me just quickly introduce once again the guest, Anthony Rudell. He's the author of the book, Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. It's published by Harcourt. That does indeed look at really the first couple of decades of radio and how it developed from something that was an amateur hobby or something that was thought of as being primarily of commercial and military use to something where just about everybody had one, or almost everybody had one, and it became a true mass medium. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have somebody in Hudsonville, Illinois, calling in. This is on our toll free line, so we'll talk with him right here, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just turned this on a little bit ago. I may have missed this. But WDZ used to say the oldest station in the nation, they were at Tuscola. How did that would you comment on that, and I'll hang up?
Well, the answer to that question is there are about a dozen stations in the country that claim to be the oldest station in the nation. KDKA Pittsburgh, and there's one in Detroit. I think it's it's not JZ, WJR in Detroit, probably are the first two. I mean, KDKA Pittsburgh was certainly the pioneer radio station. They did the first election results. They did the first boxing match. They did the first baseball game. They did the first church service. So they were right up there trying everything they could. They were owned by Westinghouse. But they're literally, in my research, I found about a dozen stations that claimed to be the first. And there's no way to figure out who really was. But in terms of pure content and trailblazing, you've got to give the award to KDK in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. You also, I guess here I'll get in a plug for this station that you're on right now. We started out as a kind of an experimental station. Mm-hmm. It was WRM, and that was 1922.
Yeah, certainly in the first 200 stations in the country then.
Yeah, so we were and have been WILL since 1928.
Okay.
And so that's a pretty long time on the air.
That's an old station.
It's an old station, absolutely. And we're still here.
Good.
Let's talk with somebody from Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Oh, you touched on a subject that's very near and dear to my heart, so thank you very much. I was curious to know, and I think some of the things you've said already lead into this. If I'm remembering rightly, the British Broadcasting Corporation was established in 1927 or 1929, right around this area that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there was ever any kind of inclination in America for a national broadcaster, which is pretty much the standard throughout Europe, Ireland, France, Germany. Pretty much all have national broadcasters. But the fact that, you know, someone like Herbert Hoover was the Secretary of Commerce at the time also sort of makes me think he was kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, he would never have countenanced, you know, this huge, you know, expansion of the powers of the federal government. And on the other hand, he hated the commercialism that was starting to come in radio at that time. And I'm sort of curious whether, you know, there was ever any inclination towards that, whether, you know, it was just a matter of who happened to be in power at the time, and if radio technology had matured sometime after 1932 and the New Deal had been in place, whether we might now today have something like the BBC here in America. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right.
The answer to that is actually before Hoover came along, the Navy in 1919 and 1920 tried to nationalize radio, and they continued to do so into 1921. And Hoover and the Harding administration felt very strongly that radio, of course, no one knew what radio was going to become at that point, you know, that it was going to become a mass medium was not on the horizon. It was just, let's try and see what happens. The Navy wanted to control it, and it ended up being in the bailiwick of the Commerce Department under Hoover. There were always discussions about nationalizing radio, but the feeling was that this was a treasure that belonged to the American people. The control that was given to the Commerce Department under the Radio Act of 1912 carried forward until the new Radio Act of 1927, which created the Federal Radio Commission. And there were always discussions about nationalizing it, but once it became a business, there was no way to go to put that genie back in the bottle. And actually, the irony is, when you look at what happened to national radio in Europe in the 1930s, especially in Germany, which was all government-controlled, the wisdom of leaving America as a bunch of independent radio stations really shone through. But, you know, there were always discussions about it. Hoover fought them. The Congress fought it. And once the business began to grow, that was the end of it.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting and very important question, because as the caller suggested, as you've commented, if you look at the way radio developed in the rest of the world, the United States essentially stands apart, because in other places they apparently they regarded the airwaves as being the property of the state,
mm-hmm.
and something that was important for the state to control and regulate. And as far as they were concerned, it was kind of like the postal service. In fact, I think in some places early on, the people who did regulate radio, it was the postal service in
yep.
a lot of places.
Absolutely.
The idea here caught on early on that it was a business, and that any within certain restrictions, anybody should be able to set up a station. And once that way of operating was kind of in place, then that's the way it was from that point forward.
What we've forgotten about 80 years or 80, almost 90 years later, is that the original intent, there are two things. One is the original intent of radio was to deliver messages, which is why in Europe so many of them were controlled by the postal organizations, because it was a way to deliver a message to another person. And it obviously grew into broadcasting from that. The other thing we forget, though, is that the Radio Acts of 12 and 27, and Hoover was a big proponent of this, that radio was a public trust, that it was meant for the public good and only for the public good. And over the last 8 decades, that has dissipated dramatically. The challenging of licenses, which used to go on much more frequently, and licenses were revoked much more frequently than they are today, was part and parcel of that Radio Act of 1927, which created the FRC. But the other thing, though, that you got to look at, and this is one of the things that I tried to bring out in the book, is that what drove American radio was the variety of programming, the geniuses who went to radio. I mean, the Rudy Valleys of the world. We think of Rudy Valley, or I thought of Rudy Valley, as a sort of iconic caricature of the 1920s, the crooner, the good-looking crooner with the girls and the raccoon coat and the megaphone. Mm-hmm. And yet, when I started doing the research for the book, I realized that Rudy Valley was about as far from that as you could be. Yes, he had that image, but he was a brilliant, brilliant radio producer who went on the air nationally 4 days before the great crash of 1929 and stayed on the air in that time slot for 520 consecutive weeks in the number one position. I mean, that's incredible. And he redefined what radio would be and what entertainment would be on the radio. So you have these geniuses in there, the Ed Wynns of the world, a guy that most people have never heard of, a guy named Graham McNamee, who was the first radio announcer. I mean, he does what you do every day, except he was the first sports announcer. He was the first straight man for Rudy Valley, the first straight man for Ed Wynn. He was the first one to call a presidential inaugural speech. He did the description of Lindbergh's return. I mean, the guy was creating the job. He was creating the business. So the programming side always fascinated me.
You mentioned that if you go back early enough in the history of radio, what you started out with was essentially a telegraph that was broadcast.
Yeah.
And then from there we get to the idea. Somebody said, well, you know, if you can do that, why couldn't you put a person's voice in there? And then from there we were off. And also, as you say, that there were within the military, they had this idea, well, this is something that has important military and security implications, and this is something that we really ought to control, and we're not really sure that this should go out to the public. Was there some particular, early on, though, particular people who were realizing, no, wait a minute, this is something that can broadcast voices and broadcast voices over long distances, and that it is something that has this great potential, certainly the potential to make money, but perhaps also that there were some social goods that could be part of that?
Well, the real business genius in all this is a guy named David Sarnoff, who was a kid working for the Marconi Telegraph Company. And in 1912, he was one of the telegraph operators who got the word of the Titanic sinking. And he rose through the ranks of American Marconi, and I think it was in 1916 or 1917, wrote a memo in which he proposed the idea of the at-home music box, where you would buy a box and it would receive a signal and it could play music for you. And he wrote this business proposal, and one of his superiors in the company told him to put it away and never show it to anyone, because no one in their right mind would send a message out that was not intended for one specific person. That the whole concept of broadcasting was ridiculous. And so he put it away, and then when American Marconi was sold to the Radio Corporation, what became the Radio Corporation of America, RCA, he revived the whole thing, and they realized that this was a business, that you could, there was a value to sending one message or one music, if you will, to hundreds of people at the same time, that this had a true value. So it was Sarnoff really was the business genius behind it all. I mean, there were others. There were people like Aylesworth, but Sarnoff was the driving force by far.
And certainly, he was somebody who was a giant in mass communications for a long time. Not only certainly in during radio, but into the point where the dominant medium becomes television.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he also, long before television, understood the synergies among different media. For example, he formed RKO, which I never realized stood for Radio Keith Orpheum. I always thought it had some other meaning. It was the Keith Orpheum vaudeville chain that he bought, and he merged it with the Radio Corporation of America to create RKO. He had the RCA Victor Company, and he realized the synergy between selling records and putting the crooner on the air to talk about the record. You know, mm-hmm. all these concepts that we think about today go back to 1920-something. And nothing's new. Let me tell you, I mean, the one I crack people up on is, you know, American Idol, this mega show that people think is so innovative and so great. American Idol is nothing more than the Major Bowes Amateur Hour,
mm-hmm.
which debuted in 1929 or 1930. And you know how they picked the winner on those shows?
Well,
you called the studio.
Yeah, it was supposedly a popular opinion poll of who did you like.
Exactly. So, I mean, American Idol is not new.
Let's talk with some other callers here.
Sure.
Let me see. I think in Hoopston is next on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Another great show. Thank you. Jogging, bringing back a lot of memories about radio. It's wonderful to reminisce. I can remember growing up in the south side of Chicago, the radio was always... Whoops.
Hello? Are you still
yeah.
there? Yeah,
okay.
We just...
I'm sorry.
We lost you for a second, but we got you back now, I guess. I don't know what happened.
Not a problem. I just remember my folks listening to something called the Don McNeil Breakfast Club, and the show was always on. And then my folks telling me about, of course, the live orchestras from Chicago, as you mentioned, and it going all over. But my point was, I think radio has a singular appeal in as much as you can listen to it while you do something else. In other words, if you're watching TV, well, for all intents and purposes, that's what you're doing. But with radio, you can stay informed, be entertained, and still, you know, pursue other interests, whatever they may be. And the other point I wanted to make was just so many of our stars, Bob Hopes and what have you, a lot of these people got their start on radio, and then they were lucky enough to make the jump to TV. But I think it's something, and I can also remember going back to the 60s, the effect of AM radio and the top 40 rock and roll stations. Of course, that's all ancient history. But anyway, just a few comments. Enjoying the show. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, you can, I don't know how you might want to follow up on any of that.
Well, you know, the comment you made about people coming out of radio, one reviewer of the book made the point that, I sort of make the point that radio was the great media revolution, and one critic said, well, that may be true, but film was bigger. Look at Orson Welles. Well, the fact of the matter is Orson Welles left film to go to radio. He didn't leave radio to go to film.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the magic of radio is what really is amazing. And the caller said, you know, you can do other things. Well, the beauty of radio is not only can you do other things, but your mind can imagine what it is they're talking about. There is no picture. There's no limitation on what you see. And I think that's what made radio so amazing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
continues to make it amazing. I shouldn't yeah. limit that.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, and I concur with the previous caller. It's always very interesting to listen to WILL. You have great programming. Your guest really touched on what I was about to say, is that radio gives you an opportunity to imagine. It's not like looking at these faces on TV, but it's more thought-provoking and imaging-raising in my view, than television, and that's one of the magic things of radio. And I find with myself that radio interests me more at my age, and I'm up there, than it did when I was a kid growing up. I would knock that the future doesn't have radio in it for older people like myself. I thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, that goes back. I guess that goes back to that thing that we were talking about right at the beginning about what the about who listens and
yeah.
And what sort of future there is for the what's going to happen to the audience in the future.
It is the ultimate companion in that sense, and shows like yours where there's talk, people love that. I did some appearances in Memphis of all places, and I flew down there and I spoke to a group, and afterwards I was talking about the 1921 Carpentier-Dempsey fight, which was one of the first heavyweight it was the first heavyweight championship bout that was broadcast. And I was talking about it and how amazing that must have been to listen to the blow-by-blow on the radio for those people who had radios, the few people in the country who had them. And a guy comes up to me afterwards and
that. I would guess he was in his early 90s. And he says to me, I remember listening to that bout. And you have this connectivity still to that era that's pretty amazing. So, I mean, it's fun when you write about the programming and then somebody says, oh, yeah, I remember hearing that. It puts a whole new meaning on it. So it's fun, though. But, you know, there are a lot of wonderful clips that take you back. I mean, some of the people you get to explore in there. You get Amos and Andy, the most popular radio show of all time. You get Ed Wynn. You get Roxy Rothafel, who actually was a brilliant radio man, and it's from him that I stole the title of the book. I mean, his sign-on was, hello, everybody. Yeah. So I felt, wow, what a great title for the book, because radio really was saying hello to everybody, as your last caller indicated.
Our guest is Anthony Riddell. He's been in radio for a long time, 10 years on the air. He's also served as vice president of programming for WQXR New York and SW Radio Networks. He's also written two books on classical music. He now consults for radio stations across the country and is the author of the book, Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio, and it's published by Harcourt and looks pretty much at about the first 20 years or so. So roughly speaking, we're talking about from the early 20s to the early 40s and how radio developed of that time and how quickly it developed. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You mentioned a little earlier that the person who got the job of trying to actually make some sense out of what was a little chaotic there at the beginning was, in fact, Herbert Hoover, who was, at the time, the Secretary of Commerce. And here we had a situation where we had a lot of amateurs, we had hobbyists who were broadcasting, and then we had people who were setting up and wanting to set up stations. And the issue here was, how do we sort this out so that stations don't interfere with each other? And it was Hoover who first set up the idea of the spectrum, in the sense that he allocated various places to certain stations.
Exactly.
And came up, at least tried to regulate it so that people could broadcast and they wouldn't be stepping all over each other.
Well, he wanted a business to grow. He wanted this industry, whatever it was going to be, to develop, and he realized that you couldn't have chaos of the airwaves. And the only way to control that was to say, okay, we're going to limit your power, we're going to limit your hours of operation, and we're going to control what frequencies you're on. So that enabled it. But Hoover's genius, and this was so amazing because we all think of him as the president. I mean, Hoover's been in the news more now since we've had an economic problem than he's been in the last 70 years, frankly. But he was maybe maligned as a president because he didn't handle the economic crisis very well that he faced. But as Secretary of Commerce, the man was a genius. He realized that in order for commerce in this country to grow and expand, it needed to be organized. And in doing the research on him, I discovered things that I didn't know. For example, Hoover standardized women's dress sizes. Doesn't seem like a big thing, but in order to order a dress from a catalog back then, from the Sears and Roebuck catalog, for example, you had no idea what your size was. There was no numeric organization to it. He organized and codified the size that bricks had to be for a building. So if you were a builder and you wanted to get, 1,000 bricks, you never knew that they'd all be the same size. You'd have to shave them down or use them, piece them together like a jigsaw. So he was this organizational genius. And radio was just one of those important things that he organized. And then he runs for president in 1928 and wins, and against Al Smith in what was perhaps one of the nastiest campaigns of all time. And I think your listeners will enjoy knowing that the Democrats charged Hoover with trying to run as if he had nothing to do with the debacle of the last 7.5 years, which sounds very familiar. And the Republicans on the radio attacked Al Smith for being a tax-and-spend, big-government, liberal socialist, all of which sounds remarkably familiar to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, that's 80 years ago. They're using the same attacks then that are being used today. But Hoover was an organizational genius. He built this industry. He built this business. He built this communication tool. And then the irony of ironies is along comes Franklin Roosevelt, who destroys him on the radio in 1932, just outmaneuvers him completely and wins the presidency. So it's a kind of neat story for Hoover, or unhappy for Hoover, I suppose.
Let's talk with some other folks here. We got
someone
calling from Indiana on a cell phone, so we'll get right there. Line one. Hello.
Yes, hi. I appreciate your programming so much. And I have a little bit of history in radio. I worked with Les Schulte at one point years ago in another lifetime. But the reason I was calling, I'd like your guests to talk about the future of radio, particularly with the internet through podcasting and so forth. And my opinion is that we're kind of in the infancy of using the internet, much as radio was back in the 20s. And I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Okay.
Well, the parallel between those first 12 years in radio and the first 12 years of the internet are really pretty staggering in terms of growth, in terms of what do you use it for. And I think your caller is right that the internet is still being developed and what its final use is going to be. By 1932, it was pretty clear what radio was going to be. I don't think there was any doubt at that point that it was going to be a vehicle for news, for politics, for religion, for sports, for everything that was American. It was the American culture panoply reflected on the air. I think the internet is becoming that, and it's still there. In terms of the future of radio, this is a question I'm being asked all the time, and if I were clairvoyant, I would probably know what to tell you. I think that there's going to be some realignment in the sense that we probably will go back to having some more important local radio. I think that the deregulations of the 90s really was not good for local radio. It created these large corporate giants owning thousands of radio stations, which homogenized the sound from coast to coast and was not a good thing. So I think you will see local radio expand again. How it interfaces with podcasting and the internet, I'm not even going to begin to venture because while I understand it all, I'm not sure I see the final direction yet. But the good news is I think it's good for programming in the sense that there are venues for this programming. And I think that's good for, you know, content is king.
Yeah. Well, then I think it's, you know, what's interesting that certainly we have seen, and it's the same kind of thing that we're starting to see more and more in television is, at least as far as radio is concerned, is listening on demand.
Yeah.
That we do, and of course now we stream live on the web so people can listen through their computer and make it into a radio. But we do also have a big, for this program and for the things we do, we have a big web archive. We have podcasting, so that means that that people, if they want to hear the show, they don't have to be in front of the radio between 10 and noon. So that's good, I think, in a sense, because it increases the potential audience. On the other hand, I guess, because I believe and we sort of believe that the part of what radio is supposed to be doing is bringing people news, talking about what's going on now and what people want to know what's on now. They want to know what the weather is.
Right.
I guess there are probably still people who do things like listen to baseball games on the radio. So
I do.
You know, having it there when it's new and when it's happening, I'm hoping that we're still going to keep doing that and that people will still want that.
The immediacy of radio is one of its great strengths. There's no question. I think, though, what you're going to see, and it's funny, I see it sort of firsthand right now, the synergy between the internet and radio can be really wonderful. I, as part of this book, had it built for me, a website, which is anthonyrudell.com, in which I have some clips and some things. But there's an audio page on it where you can go and listen to old radio. And I got to tell you, every time I do an interview like this, the traffic to that page is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a wonderful interface between a 90-year-old technology and a 10-year-old technology, which is kind of fun. So I think people who say radio's been buried more times than anything else. I mean, it's got nine lives apparently, because when television came along, who's going to listen to the radio? And then cable came along, who's going to listen to the radio? And then satellite came, no one's going to listen to the radio anymore. Then internet comes along, no one's going to listen to radio. Well, I got news for you. There are people calling this show right now who are listening to the radio. So I think the market is not going away. It's going to evolve and change, as it always has.
Let's talk with somebody in Ramsey, Illinois, next. This is a toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah?
It kind of relates to what you were just saying. I was reading an old Popular Mechanics or Popular Science magazine a couple of weeks ago, and it was talking about color television. And this thing was dated 1927, so apparently color TV was around by 1927. How did that affect radio, or how did radio affect that? Because, I never saw color TV until way up into the 60s, so I'm kind of assuming there had to be some crossover there that had some effects between one and the other.
Well, in the late 20s, you have this confluence of technological boom. You have the sound coming into movies. You have radio becoming a coast-to-coast national thing. And you have the beginnings of television. I mean, the technology existed. How to use it, no one had an idea. What it was going to be, what are you going to do with these pictures? And a lot of the research I did in reading about radio, you see people say, well, you know, this is the first step towards sending pictures now as the next thing. I mean, I don't think they call it television yet, but sending pictures through the air as part of, in addition to sound, and you put them together and all of a sudden you've got television. But it took, you know, 2.5 decades for television to take a foothold. And again, it couldn't have done it until radio had become so saturated in this country that it was accepted. So, yes, the technology existed in a very embryonic phase in 1927. I mean, no one was going to go broadcast color TV. I mean, you didn't start getting really good color movies until after that. So it was a very embryonic color TV.
Well, I kind of figured it would be the equivalent of the, you know, the starter set. But it just amazed me that all this technology had developed at such dates, and sometimes it kind of seems like we haven't gained too much since back then.
There hasn't been a huge amount of progress since then. I mean, except for the quality of the picture and the quality of the sound, and FM came along and the cable came along, but then the internet has sort of changed it. It's brought it up to the next level. But the beauty of what radio did in those first 12 years and what's in the book is all about the programming. It all comes down to what did people want to hear, or later on, what did they want to see?
Okay. Yeah, I'd say that would be the key. And sometimes I kind of wonder about where our programming on television particularly is going anymore. But thank you much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We've got about 10 minutes left here talking with Anthony Riddell. And he's the author of the book, Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. It's published by Harcourt. Certainly before radio, movies helped to create a kind of a national culture. Certainly they created people who were national stars, and that sort of went hand in hand with the other mass media of the day. And of course, movies could influence all sorts of things, what people wanted to look like, the clothes they wore, the music that they listened to, all sorts of things. But I think probably there must have been a way in which radio actually magnified that and moved us further in the direction of having a kind of a national culture.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when you start getting into the national networks, when NBC starts, you know, wrapping up radio stations from coast to coast, or when you get to the presidential elections and, you know, and a candidate makes a speech and, you know, they would announce it would be on 60 radio stations or 70 radio stations, these became big national events. And then you get to when networks come along in 26, 27, 28, you start getting national advertising and national iconic figures or national images that people know. I mean, you also start getting the great conglomerates, people buying up companies, local companies, so that they can sell the same product from coast to coast. And so sort of you lose some of the individual quality in terms of culture, but you do get this national nationalism to radio, which comes in the late 20s, which is pretty amazing. You start looking at the advertising agencies. And by the way, the advertising agencies controlled the shows. I mean, Rudy Valley's show on NBC was produced by J. Walter Thompson. It was not produced by NBC. And they bought the time from NBC for their sponsor, which was Fleischmann's Yeast, which when you think about it, you had to buy a lot of yeast to pay for that show. But, I mean, some of the wonderful sponsors, Pepsodent sponsored Amos and Andy, and it was huge. And Amos and Andy, as the Depression was descending on America, those guys were making $1 million. That was a lot of money back then. Mm-hmm. But what drove radio, really, and this goes back to your very first question in those years, were the superstars. And this is, you talk about people from film, well, it was more than that. In sports, you had Dempsey and you had Babe Ruth and the Yankees. You know, this drove people to say, hey, you know, I do want to listen to the radio. In politics, you had these great presidential campaigns ending with FDR against Hoover, and then FDR's amazing ability to go on the radio and connect with people. In religion, you have people like Amy Semple McPherson, who's driving listenership, or Robert Schuller. or Father Coughlin, who, you know, was a hugely powerful man on the air. So you have, and then of course in entertainment you have people like Rudy Valli and Roxy Rothafel and Ed Wynn and Will Rogers all going on the air, and people wanted to hear this. So it drove the industry as it built the audience, and as the audience, you know, then indicated what they liked and didn't like, radio people had a sense of which direction to go. So it was the home of stars, but they made a lot of their own stars too. I mean, Rudy Valli was one of New York's many jazz musicians and a crooner, but when he went on the air, he became a superstar.
So it really, it was the thing that made it possible to take a local celebrity or a local product or brand or a local sports team and to make something national out of all of those things.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And the power of that signal bouncing all over the country was pretty amazing. I mean, you take a guy, like I write about at the beginning of the book, a guy like John Brinkley, this quack doctor who creates a sexual rejuvenation surgery in Milford, Kansas, and he becomes the most popular radio man in the country. He goes on the air, and he never sells a dollar's worth of advertising, but he made millions from just selling his concepts. And it's a pretty amazing story, this guy, Brinkley. Another guy in Muscatine, Iowa, named Norman Baker, another quack who goes on the air and tells people he has the cure for cancer. And come to Muscatine, Iowa, and we'll cure you. And people flock there because the message delivered through the airwaves takes on a whole new power to people.
Yeah, and there are a couple, certainly, examples early on of people who recognized just how powerful the ability to broadcast and to put that message out like that really would be. Nothing else could possibly touch it in terms of getting out your message.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hoover, of all people, warned, he was very prescient, he warned about the power of the message that is delivered through the airwaves. And he said, almost anything that is received magically, as he called radio, through the magic of radio, almost anything received that way takes on an air of propaganda, which is really fascinating when you think of how forward-looking that kind of comment is.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and about 5 years old in 1925. I was at my grandma's house in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and they just invented, or whatever you call, a new radio station, and they were asking for people to recommend call numbers, for instance, you know, WILL and so forth. And so my grandma called. This is 1925, and she was lucky to have a phone. But she called, and she suggested Fernwood, Furnwood, because Grand Rapids at that time was the furniture capital of the United States, and also the furniture companies there were sending furniture to Paris and England and so forth. And anyway, so she suggested that the radio station in Grand Rapids, Michigan, have call numbers FURN for, she suggested Fernwood. To this day, the call letters in, or whatever you call them, I call them call letters or letters or whatever, are FURN. And because they used her suggestion, she was given an Atwater Kent radio. And I think that one of my cousins has that radio, whether it's still working or not, I don't know. But I'm in my early 90s now, and I think I was about 6 or 7 years old at that time, because our family, all our cousins and uncles and aunts and their grandmas, anyway, they were so amazed that my grandma won they took her suggestion, and to this day, that radio station in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is FURN.
Well, that's and I'm sure that there are all other kinds of good stories about how it is that stations came by their call letters.
Well, there's some fabulous ones. I mean, part of the fun of doing the research for the book was going back, and because the radio stations got their call letters from the Commerce Department. You could request specific call letters in those days. Now they're just issued to you. So they would request specific call letters. So, for example, WLS in Chicago was owned by Sears, and it was stood for the world's largest store. WGN in Chicago stood for world's greatest newspaper, and was owned by the Trib. There's some even more fascinating ones in other parts of the country. For example, in New York, there's a very famous station, which is WEVD, which stands for Eugene V. Debs, and it was the socialist radio station. There was one that went on the air in 1928, which was founded for the sole purpose of defeating Al Smith, and the call letters were WHAP, and that stood for We Hold America Protestant. So the call letters themselves are a great story. One of the stations, the first station in Los Angeles, was KHJ. And there were some people who said that stood for kindness, happiness, and joy, which I just think sort of sums up Los Angeles.
Yeah. When was it that the system became established that the call letters of all the stations that are east of the Mississippi started with W and everybody on the other side started with K?
Well, that actually goes back to the Navy control in pre-1920. So, and it got carried over. And the truth is, I am not 100% clear on how it developed, because you've got a station in Pittsburgh, which is obviously east of the Mississippi, which is KDKA.
Yeah.
So there are a few anomalies, but it goes back to call signs issued by the Navy in when they had control before the Commerce Department took over. But you mentioned at the very beginning of the show that WILL was an experimental radio station.
Yeah.
And there were special call signs for experimental radio stations. For example, WQXR in New York, before it went to QXR, was W2XR, which stood for the second experimental radio. And that's how we got the call letters. Hmm. So there are call letters themselves are a great story. One of my favorites, WSM, which I think is in Memphis or was in Memphis back then, was owned by an insurance company. And WSM stood for We Shield Millions. So there's no shortage of great call letter stories.
We're coming down to the point where maybe we have about a minute or,
sure.
or so left. And there's a lot of great stories in the book. So if people are interested in early radio, they should go out and take a look at the book. Maybe just you could say a couple of things about radio and politics.
The marriage between radio and politics begins with that first broadcast in 1920 of the election results. But then those political campaigns of 24, 28, and 32, each one pushing radio further and further into the mainstream. By 1932, the conventions had become staged events, as we see today. But in 24 and 28, they were kind of raucous, you know, whatever happens, happens, and they would put microphones in the hall and, you know, let it rip. And so there was a thing. But the campaigns in 32... you really see is FDR, the genius who understood the soundbite, who understood that you get on the air and you attack your opponent, and Hoover's people would go right back at him, accusing him, by the way, of being inexperienced and not ready to lead a country, which, again, is an attack we've heard recently, as I recall. But the use of radio as a tool really begins in 24 and 28 and comes to a level of maturity in 32 that's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And some of the stories I tried to weave in about that, I mean, I hope people will read the book and see what they are, because some of them are a lot of fun.
Yeah. The book is Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio, published by Harcourt, by our guest Anthony Riddell. Go out and take a look at the book. There's a lot of good stories in there. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
It is my pleasure. And keep on listening to the radio.
All right. WILL programming made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host for that show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to talk about food and the Works Progress Administration. Our guest will be Pat Willard. She is the author of America Eats on the Road with the WPA, the Fish Fries, Box Supper, Socials, and Chitlin Feasts that define real American food. She'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat trading at 557, down 6. March 571, down 7 and 3 quarters. In Chicago, the December contract 516, down 4. March wheat 534 and a half, down 6 and a quarter. December corn 369 and a half, down 14. March 386 and a half, down 15. May 397 and a half, down 16 and a quarter. July 409, down 16 and a quarter. November soybeans 894, down 46, January 907, down 41, March 916, down 41 and a quarter, May 925, down 42 and a quarter, December soybean meal 267.